verse today. Anyone know which verse it is? Oh, there it is. Bavan. Is it? Six, 12, 20. Okay. So, Srimad Bhagavatam presented by Srila Prabhupada. This is 6, 12, 20. Bhavan Atarshin Mayan Vai Vaishnavin Jana Mohinin Yad Vihaya Asuram Bhavam Maha Purushatam Gataha. This actually applies to all of us. Bhavana Tarshin Mayang Vai. Bhavana Tarshin Mayang Vai. Vaishnaving Janamohining. Vaishnaving Janamohining. Yad vihaya surang bhavam. Yad vihaya surang bhavam. Mahapurushatangata. Mahapurushatangata. Bhavanatarshin mayang vai. Vaishnaving janamohining. Yad vihaya surang bhavam. Mahapurushatangata. So, ladies, Vanatarshi Mayam Vai. So, Prabhupada's translation, Bhavan means your good self. Atarshit has surmounted Mayang, the illusory energy. Vai indeed, Vaishnavim of Lord Vishnu, Janamohinim, which deludes the mass of people, yet since Vihaya, giving up Asuram of the demons. Bhavam, the mentality. Maha Purushatam, the position of an exalted devotee, Gataha obtained. Translation, you have this is Lord Indra speaking to Vritra, Vritrasura. You have surmounted the illusory energy of Lord Vishnu, and because of this liberation, you have given up the demoniac mentality and have attained the position of an exalted devotee. Prabhupada's purport. Lord Vishnu is the Mahapurusha. Therefore, one who becomes a Vaishnava attains the position of a Mahapurusha. This position was attained by Maharaj Parikshit. It is said in the Padma Purana that the distinction between a demigod and a demon is that a demigod is a devotee of Lord Vishnu, whereas a demon is just the opposite. Vishnu Vakta Smrito Daiva Asurasta Dipariya, which is what Prabhupada just said. Vritrasura was considered a demon, but actually he was more than qualified as a devotee or Mahapurusha. If one somehow becomes a devotee of the Supreme Lord, whatever his position, he can be brought to the position of a perfect person. This is possible if an unalloyed devotee tries to serve the Lord by delivering him in this way. Therefore, Sukadeva Goswami says in Srimad Bhagavatam, Kirato hunandra pulinda pulkasha abhira shumbha javanaka sadaya jenge cha papa jara pasay asaya siddhanti tasmai prabha vishnave nama. Kiratas, hunas, which are the Huns, as in Attila the Hun. Kiratas, hunas, andras, pulindas, pulkashas, abhiras, shumbas, yavanas, and members of the Kasa race, Chinese, and Yavanas or Greeks, and even others addicted to sinful acts can be purified by taking shelter of the devotees of the Lord, for he is the supreme power. I beg to offer my respectful obeisances unto him. Anyone can be purified if he takes shelter of a pure devotee and molds his character according to the pure devotee's direction. Then even if one is a Kirata, Andhra, Pulinda, or whatever, he can be purified and elevated to the position of a Mahapurusha. Prabhupada ki jai. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Simate Bhaktivedan Samaniti Namine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Desha Tarine Bhavana Tarshin Mayang Vai Vaishnavin Janam Hohinin Jad Vihaya Surang Bhavang Mahab Purusatang Gataha. So, here Indra says to Vritra, Bhavana Tarshi, you crossed. This is the verb to cross, Tara, is a stem. And the same word, or the same root is found in the word avatara. Avatara, ava means downward. So avatara literally means one who crosses down, one who descends, to use a simple word. Descend. So, in Sanskrit, there's a sense that Krishna crosses down, crosses from the spiritual world down to the material world, and then when we get it, we cross up, so to speak. Krishna comes down here, and then we go back up there. So this is the language of the Bhagavatam. And here, Rindra says to Vritra, Bhavana Tarsing Mayang Vai Vaishnaving Janamohinim. Literally, you crossed, in the sense of you crossed over, indeed, this Maya, this illusory potency of the Lord, of Lord Vishnu, which bewilders people, Janamohinim, which bewilders people. And Janamohinim has a sense, Mohinim, not merely bewildering, but in the sense of seducing, enchanting. So we become seduced by the material nature. And the symptom of this, Indra says, you crossed over in this sense, that Bihayasuram Bhavan, giving up your demonic nature, you achieved Mahapurushatam, the position of a Mahapurusha, a great person. Mahapurusha. So, Prabhupada relates this verse to the famous verse in the second canto of the Bhagavatam, which is Kirata Hunandra Pulinda Pulkasha, which Sukadeva Goswami gives a catalog of low-class people. Low-class in the sense of sort of culturally challenged. So if there had been an America at that time, you'd probably find it in the list. This is, of course, a pre-discovery sloka. So, jnyecha papajita pasraya sraya. Sukadeva Goswami says that all these people, these barbaric and semi-barbaric people, And then he says, Janye Chapapa. And whoever else, whatever other people are sinful, Janye Chapapa. Yadapashayashaya. If they take shelter of those who have taken shelter, that's the idea. Grammatically here, that if they have taken shelter of those who have taken shelter of Krishna, Shudyanti, they are purified, therefore tasmai unto him, Prabhu Vishnave Nama. Krishna who begins this sequence of purification. So what's significant here is that there is a direct link between, in this verse, the Prabhupada quotes, and also in the Bhagavatam verse itself, there is a direct logical connection between behavior and your position. To cross over Maya means to behave in a certain way. To give up the demoniac nature. So what is a demoniac nature? Krishna, in chapter 16, says to Arjuna that we've talked a lot about religion and how to be a good person, so let's take a time out from that and talk about the other side, the dark side of the force. So chapter 16 of the Gita is the dark side of the force. It's Krishna's talking about the demoniac nature. So why is it demoniac? This is so we'll talk for a moment about this demoniac nature. I've quoted many times, there's an interesting dialogue written by Plato, in which, of course, Socrates is the speaker, the protagonist. In that dialogue called the Euthyphro, Socrates poses the question to Euthyphro, are certain deeds, are certain activities good because the gods love them? Or do the gods love them because they're good? In other words, is it that for good or evil or whatever, we have a whimsical god, a god who simply acts on his own whim? Prabhupada said Krishna acts at his own sweet will. So the question here is, Krishna obviously is independent. Krishna acts freely. That's in the first verse of the Bhagavatam, he's described as Swarat, self-governing. So the question can be raised, is Krishna's self-governance, is Krishna's independence, is Krishna's freedom, Krishna's acting at his own sweet will, does this extend into the moral domain? For example, let's say I'm walking down the street and humming a tune. Just walking down the street and humming a tune. So, let's say the tune that I choose to hum, is just at my own sweet will. I just feel like humming that tune. And I'm free to hum the tune I want. Now, under normal circumstances, without creating some very unusual scenario, under normal circumstances, my choosing to whistle that tune does not affect any other people, doesn't morally affect them. Someone passing me in the street for just a second or two may hear the tune and think, I like it or I don't like it, or he's a bad hummer or whatever. But it's not going to cause any real damage to anyone. Whereas if I walk down the street, let's say hitting people with a stick, then that's a different thing. So something, a particular activity enters into the moral realm, enters into the moral dimension, becomes an act of moral concern when it really affects other people in significant ways, either benefiting them or harming them. And so when we hear that Krishna acts on his own sweet will or at his own sweet will, does this include the moral dimension? In other words, when Krishna chooses to punish certain activities and reward other activities, is that at his own sweet will? There's no real reason for it. Krishna just randomly or arbitrarily selects certain activities and says, I like these, and so anyone that does these, I'll reward, and I don't like these other things. Almost like the way what if Krishna just, let's say, just doesn't like chocolate? Well, that would be tragic, wouldn't it? But let's say it's the case. Let's say it's the case that Krishna, let's say, just didn't like chocolate. He just didn't like it. Not because it contains a lot of the active ingredients of cocaine, which it does. Not for that reason, but just because he didn't like the flavor or something. And so you could say, well, therefore it's evil to eat that because Krishna just doesn't like it. And what if you were born in such a way that it just tasted good to you? So the question is, are there objective reasons for Krishna's decisions? When Krishna sets up the moral law, which in Sanskrit is called dharma, and in, you could say in Western philosophy it's simply called the moral law. So when Krishna sets up the moral law, and there's a long list of things that are that bring on rewards and punishments, is it simply Krishna imposing his own taste on the rest of creation, or does Krishna have some objective reason, even outside his own taste, to do so? For example, Krishna chooses to play a flute, so not a saxophone. Although we can't rule that out, right? In some remote incarnation that we're not aware of. So, in a sense, this is the question. This is the question that Plato poses. Are some activities good because the gods love them? Or do the gods love those activities because they are good? Now, for example, when we... It's an interesting question. When we offer food, we try to offer those foods which are pleasing to Krishna, which many devotees believe rules out anything that's healthy. So... Actually, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that food in the mode of goodness, and in the Gita, everything in the mode of goodness is always the best. It's the one you're supposed to choose. Food in the mode of goodness is arogyam, healthy, and ayusham. It prolongs life. It prolongs life. Anyway, a word to the wise is sufficient. So this is a philosophical issue. Krishna is a person. He has his own desires, but would Krishna punish someone simply for not having the same taste as him? For example, let's say I'm a parent and I really like vanilla ice cream and I, to my great disappointment, fathered a child that prefers strawberry. And so therefore, So whenever we go to eat ice cream, I insist that the child eat vanilla ice cream because that's what your father likes. I mean, clearly that would strike us as a very low point of parenting, as something really stupid to impose upon your child your own tastes. Now, if the parent tells the child you should be honest and not be a liar, a compulsive liar, in that case, we believe the parent is not simply imposing his or her personal taste, like, I just enjoy telling the truth more than lying. It's not analogous to vanilla and strawberry ice cream. Here's a case where the parents claim that there's an objective moral difference between honesty and being a compulsive liar. Not lying to save the life of an innocent person or one of those dramatic scenarios, but just lying. Just for the fun of it, or just to goof on other people, or just to avoid having to take the natural consequences of my activities. So therefore, we can pose the question regarding Krishna: what is the nature of God? This is theology. Theology means studying the nature of God. Is it, in other words, Krishna's rewards and punishments? The fact that Krishna encourages certain behavior and discourages other behavior, reward by rewarding and punishing them respectively, is this simply in cases where there are objective moral distinctions, like, let's say, honesty versus unnecessary lying, or does Krishna go a step further and actually impose his taste on the universe? So that not to have the same taste in everything, or let's say the guru. Some people now, if we take Prabhupada, who's a pure devotee, or other pure devotees, great pure devotees, we could pose the same question. if Prabhupada has certain taste in food, in architecture, in many other things, is this because he's reflecting Krishna's taste, which is the only morally positive taste that's allowable? Or does a pure devotee, in other words, to be a pure devotee, does it mean to be, in a sense, denatured? To be stripped of any individual nature so that you only like what Krishna likes and dislike what Krishna dislikes, even at the level, let's say, of taste, of things which, apart from Krishna's pleasure and displeasure, would have no real moral quality to it. In other words, does the pure devotee like to eat certain foods because Krishna likes those foods, and the pure devotee has no taste in food, but rather simply reflects Krishna's taste in food? Does a pure devotee have no taste in design? Does a pure devotee have no taste in music, but rather simply, transparently reflects Krishna's taste in everything? My view is, and this is an interesting philosophical point, that if we study the Bhagavatam, if we study the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we find that to be a pure devotee does not mean that an individual is not an individual. And if we study, for example, the residents of Vrindavan, we find in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu they wear different colors of dress. They wear different styles of dress. They prefer different kinds of food. We find that pure devotees sometimes fall in love with each other, as in the case of Arjuna falling in love with Krishna's own sister, Subhadra, which we could hardly take as a mundane love affair, since it involves a pure devotee and Krishna's own sister, who's on the altar in many temples. So, in other words, there's a type of impersonalism. Of course, this word is one of our favorite linguistic weapons in ISKCON, to call something impersonal. So, I want to be careful about wielding this weapon, but let me say there is something impersonal, I believe, about the philosophical conception that to be a pure devotee means to have no nature, to have no preferences, to have no taste. When in fact, again, if we study scriptures, we find that pure devotees are individuals, and they want to serve Krishna in a particular way. They enjoy serving Krishna in a certain way. They're not simply absolutely vacant, neutral serving mechanisms. And to aspire for pure devotional service does not mean that we try to strip ourselves of any particularity within ourselves, any specific nature within ourselves, any preferences, any taste, but rather it means to take who we are, to accept who we are, and then offer to Krishna. And whatever I prefer, to prefer it first for Krishna. So, somehow I got into that. So far, no lynch mobs are approaching the asana. So, here it gets back to the verse. Actually, in a surprising move, I will now connect my class to the Bhagavatam verse. What you least expected. Because here Krishna says, Indra says, he praises Vritra, to whom he's just dealt a mortal blow. And Indra says to Vritra that you gave up the demonic nature, Vihaya Asuram Bhavam. So, what is the demonic nature? Again, if you read the Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna in chapter 16 describes the demonic nature, there's nothing about cultural aesthetics. In other words, Krishna doesn't say, those who don't like kachoris, you should know to be demons. Or those who don't prefer sitar music. It's not to be, it's not culturally ideological, it's about the moral quality of the person. Krishna talks about things like lust, greed, vanity, cruelty, and things like that. And as we know, whatever the architectural design of the building you're in, however you're dressed, and so on and so forth, you can be cruel or you can be compassionate. So Krishna talks about the demonic nature in moral terms. Interestingly, so does Jesus, talks about salvation in moral terms. This then got changed into a new religious concept, which was salvation came ideologically. Not ethically, but ideologically. In other words, Jesus taught that you're saved by behaving in a moral way, and soon after he was gone and couldn't interfere with the philosophy factory of the new church, they changed it to the idea that salvation is achieved ideologically by believing something about the life and death of Jesus. Interestingly, when the criteria for salvation was changed from the ethical to the ideological, one unfortunate result of this was that we started to get a new thing in that part of the world, which was the ideological war. In other words, that it is the greatest possible sin is not to be unkind to someone, to be cruel. Rather, the greatest sin is not to have the right belief. And therefore, it is justified to kill people, not because they have behaved inappropriately towards other people, but you can kill people because they have improper beliefs. You can kill people over orthodoxy, in other words, whether because they haven't behaved properly. And before this, you find just a good old-fashioned kind of war, just territorial greed and power and things like that. But then you start to get this new phenomenon which caused a lot of evil in the world, which was the ideological war. The war in order to enforce correct belief. And this is I think, an interesting distinction. So here when Indra says to Ritra, you gave up the demonic nature, he's talking about ethical issues. Ethical issues. So then it gets back to the Platonic question of Plato, that certain acts are demonic not because they do not correspond with what we perceive to be the taste of Krishna, let's say, in food. Now, when Krishna describes food in the Bhagavad Gita, he doesn't say food that I like is good and food that I just don't care for is evil. And therefore, rather what Krishna says is that food which is clean, food which is pure, which is not rotten, food which is not obtained through violence, food which has certain objective superiority is in the mode of goodness. And so Krishna prefers certain food because it is objectively superior, morally superior, in that it's obtained by causing much less violence and harm to the environment, to other living beings, and also superior in its purity, its objective purity. So, anyway, any questions so far on these points? Yes. Not only the mood, he's not only looking for the mood of devotion, he's also concerned with our character. Every parent is concerned that the child grow up to be a good person. Krishna's also concerned that we be good people. And so, after all, you could go out and, let's say, slaughter your fellow human beings and then offer them to Krishna, and you could imagine I'm really doing this with love and devotion. Here's an anthropos steak or something.
But is there an instance? Rather, I find instance of Vidura, that Vidura's wife was offering the peel of banana instead of
yes.
banana, and Narada Muni approached, "My Lord, at least you are receiving from her. At least you could have changed or asked her to give banana instead of peel." So in reply, Krishna answered to Narad Muni and Vidura and his wife that I am neither hungry for banana or peel.
Yes, but that is, you see, philosophically speaking, that is at a different, a later stage.
But that's where we.
In other words, first we notice that Vidura's wife didn't kill an animal to offer; she took a banana. If in her ecstatic confusion she, you know, due to ecstasy, due to love, she fumbled the banana offering, then Krishna is actually accepting her devotion. We know that. However, there is moral significance in the fact that it was a banana and not a hamburger. And that's my point, that that we offer Krishna, that at first that there's Krishna's first concern is moral, and then once we, and then of course we have to offer everything to Krishna with devotion, with love, and of course Krishna is not hungry. Yes. Yes.
We carry this demoniac propensity, nature, life after life. How can we get rid of?
Well, we're not like great demons. I mean, we shouldn't flatter ourselves that we're really great demons. The fact that you're here right now, the devotees, in ISKCON, there's sort of like the cultivation of extreme humility and self-effacement. Actually, this leads to an interesting philosophical mistake, which is also common. There are philosophical mistakes even among ourselves. One common philosophical mistake among us is the idea that I'm here by Krishna's causeless mercy. I did nothing to deserve this. It was all Krishna's mercy. That sounds very good and pious, but unfortunately it contradicts several verses of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Jayajata, I reciprocate with everyone. And Krishna also says, Samohang, Sarvabhutesha, I'm equal to all creatures. So if it were, in other words, in exchange for this hyper-humility, that I did absolutely nothing, I am the most fallen. Again, self-flattery. I am very fallen. I did nothing to deserve it. If that were true, if it were actually true that you did nothing to deserve to be here, then it would also logically have to be the case. Something else would have to be true, which would be terrible. Namely, that there are other souls in the world absolutely equal to you, as qualified as you, that Krishna is sending to hell. And so we'd have this monstrous situation where parents have two children who are equally deserving, and the parents give one child every possible reward, and the other child they just slap around and, you know, lock up in the goat shed or something. And the two children are actually equally deserving. I mean, what would you think of parents like that? Interestingly, in early Christian history, They also got into this hyper-piety. And, I mean, it's a nice ecstatic mood to say sometimes, I'm so fallen, I have no qualification. As long as you don't let that encroach upon your philosophical understanding. In other words, we have to have in reserve a clear philosophical understanding. And so if you keep that, then you can, you know, indulge yourself in ecstatic humility. Interestingly, the Christians got into this very soon after Jesus was gone, and they were free to speculate to their heart's content. And they also developed this hyper-piety where they thought that if you say that in any way we have done good, we have earned this, we deserve this, if you say that in any way, you are taking away from the glory of God. So let's give 100%, 1,000% of the glory to God. In order to do that, you can't have any of the credit. You have to give up all the credit and say that you did nothing, you deserve nothing. Now, the philosophical question was raised, but that means that God is not equal to everyone, because some people who also are undeserving are not going to heaven? The answer to this, which I hope you will not find satisfying, because I think it's obviously not satisfying and not really reasonable, is that God is not discriminating because no one deserves to be saved. Every one of us is evil. Anyway, that whole thing. We're all evil. However, therefore, God is not required, even by the common rules of reciprocity, to save anyone. So if he just kind of indulges his own divine whimsy, and it's almost like the Roman emperor going to all the condemned prisoners after he's thrown to lions and whimsically saying, okay, you and you are saved. Because everyone deserves to be killed. This is sort of a very positive, you know, optimistic view. This is also Paul's. Anyway, we won't go into all these bright philosophical points. So, but God just, he doesn't save anyone, so therefore he's not being unfair when he whimsically saves some people and sends others to hell because he's not required to save anyone. I say, this is not philosophically satisfying. It really doesn't get to the point at all. So therefore, the idea that we have no merit, we don't deserve anything, it's nice sometimes as an ecstatic sentiment, but it should not twist our philosophical understanding, which we find in Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, in fact, he does reciprocate with everyone. Yes.
In this question of how to act in relationship to Krishna and the moral implications and everything, don't we all have to take into account our position in devotional service? We know what the definition of pure devotional service is.
Yes.
But we also have to take into consideration not only our individuality, but also what level we're on, to know how much we can, to what level we can surrender.
Yes, exactly.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I think you stated it very nicely. It's become a cliche in ISKCON now that we were kind of like pre-transcendental in the early days. We sort of jumped over things like being a good human being and jumped right to the deep nectar. So self-realization means that you've got to figure yourself out, to separate everything. This is soul, this is matter, this is matter, this is soul. To separate things out in your own consciousness when you have certain emotions, certain thoughts, to actually know what is pure and what is impure, you have to not only have a generic understanding, okay, this is lust, this is maya, this is desire to serve, that's Krishna. But even in the desire to serve, there can be selfishness and vanity. And even in our selfish desires, there may be a trace of goodness if we can find it. And so to really sort yourself out and do practical self-realization, you have to know specifically what your impurities are. You have to really understand yourself. And sometimes that means I don't mean to say indulgent. I don't want to start preaching Rajneesh philosophy here. It's not that we just indulge all of our evil, dark side of the force desires, but sometimes, as we know, Krishna says, what can repression accomplish? He says, everyone follows their nature, so what is my nature? How do you discover your nature? How much rain? How much do you allow your nature to act so that you can understand it, so that you won't end up, you know, it's like repressing something that later explodes in a much more violent, messy way. That Krishna says it's the art of all activities. It's not only a science, it's an art. It's trying to understand how to understand yourself as a human being, how to understand yourself as spirit soul, how to transcend. It's a great spiritual science and art. Yes, PREG.
Can you explain what Srila Prabhupada meant that I've created your good fortune? Like, because devotees were saying how they did this in order to become devotees, and Srila Prabhupada said something like that I made your good fortune.
Yes, first of all, I would say it is dangerous to take these Prabhupada stories in a way that sort of statements by Prabhupada transcend and even nullify the Shastras and nullify Prabhupada's own purports. So a guru obviously has to teach the disciple to be humble, to be obedient, to be grateful. And so therefore it's a fact that Prabhupada created our good fortune. But why did he create our good fortune, not someone else's good fortune? There are also statements from Prabhupada that say that you accepted it. One devotee said to Prabhupada, actually it was Vishnujana, said to Prabhupada that it's all your mercy, Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, no, my mercy is there for everyone, but you accepted my mercy. So the act of accepting Prabhupada's mercy, the act of allowing Prabhupada to create good fortune for us, because we did. We allowed Prabhupada to create good fortune for us. We chose to let that creation happen. And that itself is meritorious. And it would be, I think, silly to say that there's no merit, there's no deserving, there's no credit in cooperating with the pure devotee who's trying to create your good fortune. Every time Prabhupada gave a lecture, he was urging everyone to allow him to create good fortune for them. And some people just walked away. And some people stayed. So again, we should cultivate gratitude and humility, but not at the cost of a correct philosophical understanding. And that, it's a kind of yoga maya. A devotee feels very humble. In other words, we can feel worthless. We can, not in the sense where you just have a self-esteem problem. It's just like some kind of mundane psychopathology. And as we know, ISKCON itself is a full catalog of all possible emotional disorders. Precisely because devotees are coming from the material world and it's a hospital. It's like in a very large hospital, you find all kinds of diseases. So ISKCON's a very large hospital. So there is a healthy way to feel that I'm very fallen, and there's an unhealthy way to feel that way. But the healthy way to feel very fallen is that at the same time I feel worthless and all those words we use about ourselves, at the same time we feel that way, we are very confident and enthusiastic and joyful about Krishna's mercy. And we know that Krishna is saving me, Krishna is blessing me, Krishna is empowering me. I will have a great life by His mercy, and yet I'm very fallen. So there's a type of healthy humility in which a devotee is actually strong, enthusiastic, and very confident in Krishna's mercy. To think ill of yourself and not to trust Krishna's mercy qualifies you for counseling services. Back there, yes?
Say someone is going to a self-help course, how to become wealthy. And and they go through all these steps, read all the books, ingest this whole philosophy, and then they, in fact, become wealthy. And then someone would say, well, did they become wealthy because they took the steps and the courses and that's how they changed their mind to think prosperously instead of in a poverty consciousness, to use the terms? Or is it because that was just their karma?
Well, to some extent you could say it's like when you get those credit cards in the mail and then you have to call a number and activate them. And so karma is like a type of credit, but sometimes you have to activate it. And although some people making no effort get something, and some people making all effort lose everything. So if someone is enthusiastic to enrich the authors of these books, if someone is enthusiastic to do all these courses, then you could say that's just their propensity. people are born with certain propensities, and if they're lucky, they also have the karma which fulfills their propensities. People have always done things like that. There's always been some kind of apprentice system in the world. And so in a sense, someone who takes, you know, reads a book is like an apprentice to trying to make money and having certain confidence, you know, doing it in a certain way. But it's not sufficient. Otherwise, if it were really true that you could just read these books and get rich, there would be a lot more rich people in the world instead of just the authors of the books. Yes.
He was explaining to them that...
Prahlad.
Yes. Yes. He was saying that it's completely futile to... Well, I use the word futile. I thought that was the word, but it's futile. It was completely futile to endeavor for any kind of economic development, to increase your happiness, to try to avoid any type of distress. In fact, we were talking about it in relationship to these seminars that everyone is loving to go to. And we were saying that this was a good argument why it was futile to go to these things. It's impossible, as you explained by Prahlad.
Yes. However, but if we took this too far, to an extreme, then you could argue that no one, for example, should go to college. No one should learn to do anything. No one should learn to do any kind of job. No one should learn to be a carpenter or a lawyer or anything, because why do you learn these trades to make money? But since you can't make more money than you're destined to, no one should learn a trade. In fact, no one should get out of bed in the morning. And we could, you know, well, John Lennon tried that for a while, didn't he?
What's the secret?
The secret.
Yeah, what's the, as Prabhupada said...
Go to my website, where lower prices may be available. No, the secret is... The secret is, I think that we have to be balanced, because there are certain activities like learning a trade, getting an education. After all, I mean, it wouldn't be responsible for parents to tell their kids, the kid says, I want to go to college, and the parents say, no, just read Prahlad's instructions again. Just, you know, stay at home and wait for your karma. Because Krishna, what balances that statement by Prahlad, not doesn't refute it, but balances it, is Krishna's statement in the Bhagavad Gita that your duty is born of your nature. So if it is your nature, let's say, to make money, then it's your duty to go out and do that. And then, of course, it's finally your duty to offer it to Krishna or to his bona fide representatives. So go to my website. So there's another point in the Bhagavad Gita which explains this. Krishna says that action in the mode of goodness is kartavyam iti jat karma. Karma which is done with the mentality, it's my duty. So now let's say someone has a propensity to do business. And therefore, first of all, Krishna says, it's your duty. Because it's your propensity, it's your duty. And it's dangerous not to do it. The second thing Krishna says is that in performing this duty, born of your nature, that you can do that afterwards. In performing this duty, born of... That's why I said it afterwards. In performing this duty, born of your nature, your goal should not be just greed or pride, but to do your duty. So someone can say, it's my propensity to do business, therefore it's my duty, and I want to do it well. And because I'm doing it for Krishna, I want to do it well, and therefore I'll take courses, or I'll learn this or that. And ultimately, so that's the mode of goodness. If I'm doing my duty out of passion, because I'm greedy or proud, that's what Prahlad's talking about. And Krishna's whole point in the Gita is that the activity doesn't change. Arjuna was still a kshatriya. So when you realize that it's futile to endeavor for material sense gratification, it doesn't change your duties. It doesn't change your activities. It just changes your consciousness. So perhaps we'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.